Welcome to the Northeast Christian Podcast. We're so excited that you've decided to check out our weekly messages. We hope that you're challenged and inspired by what you're hearing today. We'd love to have you join us this weekend at one of our campuses or online at northeast.live. For more information on Northeast, visit us at necchurch.org. If you love the Northeast Podcast, subscribe to our channel and leave us a comment or a rating in the Apple Podcast Store. This weekend's message is from Tyler McKenzie. He's the lead pastor here at Northeast.
All right, that being said, down to business today. We're in week three of a four-week sermon series we've been doing called Common Ground. Common Ground. And the series has been built on one nerdy, but one really, really important question. Okay, can science and faith exist in the same universe? Now, if you weren't here for the first 2 weeks of the series, you gotta go back and catch up because we laid some groundwork in those first 2 weeks that will help make today's sermon make even more sense to you. But if you didn't, I think today you'll still be able to understand everything we're saying, but go back this week and catch up because it'll bring some richness to what we're saying. Now, in the first 2 weeks, I hope to, at the very least, have answered this question with a resounding yes. Can science and faith exist in the same universe? Yes. Yes. Don't be silly. Don't be stubborn. Yes, of course it can. In fact, right in this very moment, science and faith do exist in the same universe. And believe it or not, science and faith can even exist in the same mind without conflicting or competing with one another, but rather complementing one another. So yes. Now, as we've discussed though in the first 2 weeks, the reason why we have to have this conversation is because there's been this false dichotomy created in the popular conversation that it's not science and faith, but rather it's science or faith, and you have to choose. And this false dichotomy has been created largely by the extremists in the conversation because they get most of the airtime and they're just hateful. Like, they just hate each other. In fact, sometimes I think their mission isn't to prove their point, but it's to prove their enemies wrong. So they just hate on each other. They drag their enemies' credibility through the mud, their character through the mud, their mama and their dog through the mud. I mean, it's just like whatever they can drag through the mud, they do it because they hate them. And that's what extremists do. Extremists don't deal in reason, they deal in propaganda. Extremists don't deal in open-mindedness, they deal in intolerance. And that's what you see, and the whole conversation has become toxic. So my hope in the first 2 weeks of this has been to show you that it doesn't have to be toxic. In fact, science and faith can work together. In fact, you know what we believe here? We believe in science. We do. But we also believe that life goes beyond what can be accounted for by just science alone. It's a marriage of the two. We believe in science, no doubt about it. In fact, the Christian who's living the Christian worldview right doesn't shun science, but rather they embrace it as an avenue through which they can better get to know the Creator God of the universe. We believe in science. Okay. But we also believe that life goes beyond that. Some of the most foundational assumptions of science cannot be explained without faith. And in my opinion, in particular, the Christian. Now, that having been said, let me be even more forward, okay? You know what my number one hope has been in this series? My number one hope. Okay, my number two hope has been to educate. To hopefully educate the people who call Northeast their home, you know, our online, to educate our people on this perceived conflict and on how to better have conversations with your friends and your family members. That's been my number two hope. But that's not been my number one hope. You know what my number one hope has been? My number one hope has been that there are some skeptics in our audience. Some folks who have grown cold on Christianity or have even walked away from the church because they perceive this anti-intellectualism within the church. My hope is that some of you have stuck with us. Maybe 5 of you, 10 of you, 100 of you. And because of the arguments that we have made, and that we will continue to make, my hope has been that you have just begun to consider God again. And you see, it is in fact to you that today's sermon is addressed, to the spiritual seeker in the room, to the hopeful agnostic, to the dechurched wanderer who wonders if in fact life goes beyond science. I want to show you today that what makes Christianity so compelling is that it explains our outer world, as we've seen the last 2 weeks, but it also explains our inner world as well. When you bring the two together, you bring your inner world and outer world together. It makes both rational and emotional sense of your life. And it's a very, very satisfying place to live. That's what I want to show you. The Christian God makes rational and emotional sense. Now, before we get to talking about your inner world and how that intersects with, you know, science and everything, I feel like we need to spend a few minutes establishing common definitions. Okay, in particular, a common definition around the Christian God, because sometimes this gets confused in church. So let me start off today with point number one, and for some of you this is review, but for others of you this is important to hear. We Christians believe that God, the Christian God, is Jesus. Jesus is God, and God is Jesus. Now some of you are like, duh, but here's the deal. I need to say that, because even Christians in this room don't usually immediately think Jesus when they hear the word God. If I were to ask everybody to pull out a piece of paper today and write on that piece of paper the top, you know, four or five traits of God that you think of when I say God, normally words come to our mind like this: powerful, creator, invisible, sovereign, majesty, authority. And all those are true, no doubt. According to the sacred texts of Christianity, all those are true of God. But according to the scriptures, there is a truer revelation of God than even any of those words right there, and that truer revelation is a person, the person of Jesus. That's what Christians believe. In John chapter 14, Jesus is having this conversation with one of his disciples, Philip. It's the last night of his life. And Philip is like sensing that Jesus is going somewhere. He's not sure where he's going, but he's like, I think Jesus is leaving. So he makes this last second request of Jesus. He says to him, Lord, okay, before you leave, show us the Father. Just show us the Father. That's why we're here. So show us the Father and we will be satisfied. And then Jesus said to him, ta-da. I mean, have I been with you all this time, Philip? Ta-da. Okay, and you still don't know me? Ta-da. Come on, Philip, whoever has seen me has seen the Father. So, ta-da. I mean, it's a clear statement of identity, right? One of my favorites comes in Hebrews chapter 1, the third verse, where the author of Hebrews says this. He says, Jesus radiates God's own glory and expresses the very character of God. Now, this phrase here, he expresses the character of God, is an interesting one. In ancient days, Jesus' day, they used to have this practice where they would take metal and an engraver, and then they would press into that metal an engraving of the emperor. Like, on the engraver it would be like a picture of the emperor, of his, like a depiction of his head or something, and some of his titles underneath it. And they would press it onto the metal, and they would use that metal as currency. Very similar to what like our quarters or pennies look like today. You got like a president on it and some of our national mottos. That's what they did back then. And that's what this phrase is pointing to. And what a powerful image that is. The author of Hebrews is telling us that on human flesh, in Jesus, we see God, who he is, stamped in, engraved, the very glory and character of God. In John chapter 1, Jesus' best friend, after spending 3 years hanging out with him and then decades meditating on it, says this. He says, in the beginning, the Word, which was just a really, really fancy philosophical name that John gave for Jesus. Okay, you know what the word comes from? It comes from the Greek word logos. Logos. In Jewish thought, you know what the logos was? The logos was the creative power behind the universe. Because you see, Jewish folks believed that God created the universe through his spoken word. It had a very, very high meaning to them. Now, in Greco-Roman thought, many of the philosophers believed that the logos was something like the unifying force that brought the universe together. So no matter who was reading John's text here, whether it was a Jew or a Greek, whether it was Jew or Greco-Roman, this was a powerful idea. Taking the word logos and associating with Jesus, they would have said, wow, that's a high term. But John is unfazed. He says, no, that's who Jesus is. In the beginning, the logos, Jesus, the word, already existed. And the word was with God. And the word was God. And he existed in the beginning with God. And God created everything through him. And nothing was created except through him. And the word gave life to everything that was created. And his life brought life brought light to everyone. Now, don't you see? When we Christians say God, we have a very, very specific definition in mind. And it's not just a power, it's not just a principle, it is a person, the person of Jesus. And I would suggest to you that if you want to get to know our God, the Christian God, just get to know Jesus. Okay, now for some of you, this is not how you were raised. You were not raised to know God as Jesus. You were raised thinking that God was I don't know, this like distant clockmaker who spun the cosmos into existence and then sort of stepped away. Or maybe some of you were raised thinking God was so, ambiguous and invisible that you didn't even bother with him. Or for some of you who grew up in certain religious traditions, maybe you thought God was a person. He was this white-bearded old man who sat on a throne with a lightning bolt in hand, and he was constantly looking at you going, no. Like, that was God's word to you. It wasn't the Bible. It was no growing up. Especially when you were a teenager. It was like, no, definitely no. You know, lightning bolt. Like, this is what you thought. Now, if this was your vision of God growing up, I'm just saying, you got the wrong vision. That's not the Christian vision of God. According to the Christian vision of God, God is not some sort of legalistic despot. No, he actually only has two rules, according to Jesus. And according to the Christian vision of God, God is not distant. Rather, he drew near in Jesus. And according to the Christian vision of God, God is not invisible. Rather, he made himself quite visible and quite historical in Jesus. Our God is a personal God. He created people in his image, then became a person, quite literally loved them to death, and desires a personal relationship with you. So if you want to get to know him, it's simple. Get to know Jesus. And you'll figure out everything you need to know. Now, that having been said, here's the second piece of the definition you need to now understand. One, the Christians believe that God is Jesus. So two, that's why we believe God's defining characteristic is cross-shaped love. Because that was Jesus' defining characteristic. John chapter 13, verse 34. Jesus said to his disciples, "I give you a new commandment, that you love one another." What do you mean, love, Jesus? Well, I'll tell you what I mean. Just as I have loved you. That's what kind of love I want you to show. The just as I have loved you kind of love. You also should love one another. By this, everyone will know that you're my disciples, if you have love for one another. Now, interestingly enough, Jesus actually says this to his disciples at the Last Supper. This is the night that he was betrayed. Literally hours after he says this, he's arrested. And then hours after he is arrested, he's nailed to a cross. So when he says, the just as I have loved you love, he has a specific vision of what that love looks like in his mind. And it's cross-shaped love. It's what he shows them next, and it's what he calls them to. That's what love is for Jesus. Philippians chapter 2, verse 6. Paul says it like this. He says, though Jesus was God, he didn't think of equality with God as something to cling to. Instead, he gave up his divine privileges. He took the humble position of a slave and was born a human being. And when he appeared in human form, he humbled himself in obedience to God and died a criminal's death on a cross. Oh, what a vision of God. We don't just serve a God who's sitting on a throne ruling. We don't just serve a God who created everything. We serve a God who became something and then did something for all of us. This is, again, why John says in 1 John 4, God is love. I spent 3.5 years with Jesus. I've been reflecting on it for decades, and so I have come to this conclusion, he says. God is love. And he showed us how much he loved us by sending his one and only son to the world so that we might have eternal life through him. This is real love. Excuse me, what's real love, John? I'll tell you. Not that we loved God, but that he loved us and sent his son as a sacrifice to take away our sins. You know what one of my favorite passages is? 1 Corinthians chapter 2. Because in 1 Corinthians 2, the Apostle Paul writes to the church that he spent lots of time with in Corinth. Now, you need to know this about Corinth. Corinth was a crazy place. Corinth was like this port town, so all the nonsense was going on in Corinth. Okay, you think the church is jacked up today? Let me introduce you to Corinth. They should do a reality TV show on Corinth because it was just nutty. The Real Housewives of Corinth, that would sell, right? I'm serious, people would watch it because it was just crazy. And yet, when Paul rolled in there, he had a very, very specific message for this place. And he reminds them in 1 Corinthians 2 where he started with them when he told them the story of God. He says, you guys remember when I first came to you, dear brothers and sisters? I didn't use lofty words and impressive wisdom to tell you God's secret plan. For I decided that while I was with you, I would forget everything except Jesus Christ, the one who was crucified. Christ crucified. See, according to Paul, all beliefs are important, but not all beliefs are equally important. There is that one belief that is more foundational and fundamental than the rest, and that is Christ crucified. In the crucified Christ, we see who God is. We see God's compassion and calling for us. We see our salvation and purpose, and that's where he starts. And that's where we start with God. Now, are we all on the same page now? This is the Christian view of God. That having been said, let's talk about your inner world now. All right, third. I believe that explains our unshakable soul longing for love. If the God of the universe is really essentially and substantially cross-shaped love, then that explains why inside of us all, it's part of the human condition, y'all. Inside of us all, there is this deep longing for love. You ever notice this about us human beings? That we need to receive and give love in order to be satisfied. We need to receive love. Like, we got to find our people, a place where we belong. But we also need to give it, because when we give love, we discover purpose. Purpose and belonging, it comes together in love. Look, you can have the whole world, but if you don't have love, you got nothing, right? You're empty. I know people who have the whole world and are empty because they have no love. And that's because there are these cross-shaped holes in every single one of our hearts that could only be filled by love. So, okay, maybe I could ask it to you like this, all right? What's the key to a life well-lived? Understanding science or love? That seems kind of obvious to me. I don't know, but let me ask you this one. What leads to maximum happiness and joy in life? Is it science or love? Now, look, I'm not anti-science or anything. I just believe there's a more fundamental truth to the universe than even science. Maybe I could say it like this. What does every human being long for the most? Science or love? See, the answer to the question for me, it just seems so obvious. And that's what I would expect and what you should expect if the creator behind us all is a God who is love, essentially and substantially love. You see, that's why at Northeast, we encourage all of our people to live the Love the Ville lifestyle. You've heard us talk about it. You've seen this diagram before. We want our people to unleash Jesus' cross-shaped love, which is a very specific brand of love, but we want them to release that in every sphere of influence that you got. Like out in the city. That's why we have outreach weeks like this. We want to be out in the city serving the least of these, serving the underserved, serving the less privileged, serving the unloved. But you also need to have a strategy to unleash the love in your other spheres of influence, like in the home. Some of you are raising kids, and you are a great influencer of those kids. Some of you are married, and your husband or your wife, God's called you to pastor them on his behalf. Or maybe you've got a roommate. You spend so much time with that roommate. Good God, he knows you have influence over them, and you need to have a strategy to love them. Same thing for the workplace. Some of you spend 60, 70 hours a week at work. Holy cow, if you're not living for God at work, are you really living for God? You gotta have a strategy there, a Love the Ville strategy there. And what about in this church? We're the body of Jesus. We're his physical representation in the world today. People make assumptions and judgments about Jesus based on us, and so we better be together, right? We better be together. This is what we want for us. This is our spiritual formation strategy for you. Now, I believe that boils down in a real practical way to three practices that we just hammer over and over and over here. Generosity, servanthood, and community. Generosity, servanthood, and community. If you're practicing those things, you will find yourself following not far behind Jesus. Generosity, servanthood, and community. Because that's what he teaches love looks like. And here's what's so interesting. Jesus doesn't just teach that's what love looks like. Research has proven That generosity, servanthood, and community are actually the key to living a fulfilled life. Okay, so first, generosity. Harvard Research recently came out with a study that showed that one of the best ways to increase your happiness is to contribute generously to a cause bigger than yourself. Generosity is a number one indicator of happiness. Now, the study went on to show that happier people actually live longer, and so the study suggests that, well, generosity is a matter of life or death. Servanthood. About 10 years ago, New York Times released an article called Happiness 101. It was on positive psychology. Positive psychology is a branch of psychology that tries to research, measure what makes people happy. I love this article. I go back to it often. Because in this article, it makes two points. One, first point it makes is if you focus on doing things for you, it does not lead to happiness, but it produces what they called a hedonic treadmill. Can you see the image in your mind? It's like you're just running. You're chasing after happiness. You're chasing after pleasure in life by focusing on yourself. But then all of a sudden you look down and you realize, I ain't gaining no ground because I'm on a treadmill. I'm getting nowhere. In fact, all I'm getting is tired and exhausted. That's where most of us are at. Now, on the flip side, though, the article goes on to point out this. Say, on the flip, if you focus instead on doing things for others rather than you, it actually gives you a sense of meaning, purpose, and significance that leads to an enduring happiness. And doesn't that make sense? Doesn't it make sense if the God behind it all is Jesus, and Jesus said, I came not to be served, but to serve and give? Community. One of my favorite studies on community was done by a neuroscience researcher from the University of Chicago. He studied loneliness for over 20 years, and this is what he wrote. He said, according to science, humans are a social species. The biological machinery of our brains warns us when our ability to prosper is threatened. Hunger is a warning our blood sugar is low and we need to eat. Thirst warns us we need to drink to avoid dehydration. Pain alerts us to potential tissue damage. And loneliness tells us that we need connection, something as critical as food and water. Now, another group of researchers went on to find that living with air pollution increases your odds of dying early by 5%, obesity, 20%, excessive drinking, 30%, and loneliness, 45%. The study says that in-person interactions actually bolster our immune system, send positive hormones surging through our bloodstream and brain, and help us live longer. Research shows that playing cards once a week or meeting friends every Wednesday for coffee adds as many years to our lives as taking beta blockers or quitting a pack-a-day smoking habit. In short, building community is a matter of life or death. So don't you see? Generosity, servanthood, community. They're the keys to life. And that's so backwards, and it's kind of counterintuitive to think that giving yourself, pouring yourself out for others is actually what pours life back into you. But it's the way of life, and it's the way of the cross. Because see, in Jesus, we see a man who poured his life out for others and had resurrection life poured back into him. And that's the promise for you and me today. When we pour our lives out for others, when we follow Jesus, carry our cross, and sacrifice our lives for others, we have new life poured back in. Which is why I would suggest to you that the Love the Ville lifestyle is the only way to truly live. Now that brings me to point number four. All this having been said, this is why I would make the argument today that love plus science, not just science alone like some with the without God worldview say, but love plus science actually explains everything. It brings everything together. It brings both our inner world and our outer world together in a way that makes rational sense. In fact, it's almost like love is a flashlight and science is a flashlight, and they both illuminate truth. But they illuminate it from a little bit of a different angle so that when you look over here or when you look from over here, you see the truth in a little bit of a different way. Are you with me? Okay, so one Christian scientist said it like this, and I thought this was really good. He said, suppose you ask, why is this water boiling on the stove? Well, as a scientist, he said, I may say that heat energy from the gas flame is being conducted through the copper base of the kettle and is agitating the molecules of the water to such an extent that the water is boiling. and he would be right. Or, he said, I may say that the water is boiling because I would like a cup of tea. And he would also be right. Now he writes, we see at once that both of these explanations are equally rational. They both make perfect sense, but they are very different. The first is scientific and the second is personal, involving my intentions, will, and desire. What is also obvious is that the two explanations don't conflict or compete, but they complement each other. Both are in fact necessary for a full explanation of what is going on. Now, let me bring this into the real world for you here, okay? This is a cake, okay? And let's pretend for a second that my mama, my wonderful mama, baked this cake. She didn't bake this cake. I went and actually got it from Kroger, which we got to get these Kroger kids that work in the bakery under control. They gave me a cake without a slice, and I do not know where that slice went. But sell a sliceless cake. Do you know where it went, David? I don't know. Maybe you know where it went. But okay, so check this out. Let's pretend that my mama brought me this cake. And she would, by the way, do this. She comes to visit like once every month or two, drives 7 hours from North Carolina. It's really to see the grandkids, but to console me, she like brings cake or cookies. So let's pretend she brought me the cake. And you saw this cake sitting here on the table. And you asked me the question, okay, preacher, why is there a cake on that table? Well, if I were to hand the microphone to the scientists, they might have one explanation. They would say, well, I'll tell you what. You know, the biochemists would explain the proteins and the fats and the composition of it, and the chemists would explain the elements, and the physicists would explain the fundamental particles, and the mathematicians would come up with some equation to explain how it all came together. And they would be right in their explanation. I'm sure of it. They'd be right. But if we then took the microphone from them and we handed it to my mama, and we said, hey, mama, why is there a cake on that table? She would have a very different explanation. You know what she would say? She would say, because I love my baby boy. And she would be right as well. Now, do you see the difference between the two explanations? Do you see the difference? They're both true, but they're both very different. One articulates the truth of the cake's composition, while the other articulates the truth of its intention. And without the truth of its loving intention, the loving intention of the maker, the composition would have never came about to begin with. Do you guys want this cake? Your parents are out of town. Eat as much cake as you want. Come on. Come on, Richardson kids. All right. Enjoy Punta Cana. Your kids will be enjoying chocolate chips. Okay. So let me explain it like this. And this might make more sense for some of you. When it comes to God, you got to go with either one of two things. Either there is a God or there is no God. Now, if you're a Christian and you believe there is a God, that means you believe the driving force behind the universe is God and love, or a God of love. But on the flip side, if you believe there's no God, then that means you believe the driving force behind the universe is science and math. Now, what's fascinating is I've found that depending on which way you lean first, you tend to ask different questions of life. Like, for example, those in a without God worldview, they tend to ask questions determined by the scientific method first. Questions like how and what, when and where. While on the flip side, those who lean in the religious direction first, they ask those scientific questions eventually, but they start with more relational, more purpose-driven questions like who and why? Questions of intention, if you will. So let's take another example. Let's take the origins of the universe. If we were to ask the without God, you know, worldview scientists, why is the universe in existence? They would do a tremendous job of explaining to us how, what, when, and where. They would tell us about, you know, the Big Bang theory and the multiverse theory and how it all comes together. And yet here's the only problem with that. What science is unequipped to do is to answer the intention questions. It can tell us how, what, when, and where, but it can't tell us who and why. Now, at this point in the argument, usually, you know, my non-Christian friends will be like, okay, and yes, I see where you're going, Tyler. So you're gonna tell us the who and the why is God. Oh, how convenient. What a fantasy that is. And maybe they're right. Maybe it is a fantasy. But you know what sounds like more of a fantasy to me than the idea that an intelligent designer created everything? The idea that nothing created everything. Now that, my friends, is a fantasy. Come on. The idea that in the beginning, there was nothing. And nothing decided to do something that created everything. It's interesting. Tell me more about this nothing, because it doesn't sound like nothing to me. In fact, if this nothing did something, then it's not nothing plus something equals everything. It's actually something plus something equals everything, which is kind of the point I'm trying to make here. So at the end of the day, you gotta choose. You gotta look at both sides of the equation. You gotta decide which one sounds more logical, which one makes more rational and emotional sense to me. And if you lean into the without God worldview, I just wanna remind you, you believe that the driving force of the universe is science and math. But here's what I promise you. You will not spend the rest of your life searching and longing for math. You'll spend the rest of your life searching and longing for love. And that's what we should expect as human beings who are created by an intelligent designer who is essentially and substantially love. So all that having been said, that brings me to my last point, and it is my challenge. For every single person in this room today, whether you believe or whether you don't, I want to challenge you. Number five, don't be a hypocrite. Don't be a hypocrite. Quick review. We Christians believe God is Jesus, and thus God's defining characteristic is cross-shaped love, because that's Jesus' defining characteristic. And that explains the fact that we have a creator God who is love. That explains our unshakable soul longing for love. That explains why when you bring love together with science, it actually begins to make sense of all of our lives. So I just want to challenge you. Don't be a hypocrite. Christians, look up here. This is important. Look up here. Don't be a hypocrite. You know what frustrates people so much about Christianity? It's not Jesus. It's his followers. Because they say there's this God of love out there that they believe in, this God who revealed himself to us on a cross, but then they live in the exact opposite way of a cross-shaped life, and they don't seem to care about it. That's hypocrisy. So I'm not calling you to be perfect, I'm not, but I am calling you to try, because Jesus is calling you to try. And in those moments when you fall short, point to God's grace, point to Jesus' cross, and I can promise you this, those outside the faith won't call that hypocrisy. They'll actually call that humility, because it is. But I pray, there's one thing I pray over this church more than anything else. Let us do everything we can not to be hypocrites. Don't be a hypocrite. Now, non-Christians in the room, okay? If you're like the spiritual seeker, the hopeful agnostic, look up here, okay? My challenge to you is the same. Don't be a hypocrite. Don't say you believe one thing, but then live in a completely contradictory way to that. Don't be a hypocrite, because that's what hypocrisy is. See, here's the interesting thing. Every worldview, whether it's the Christian worldview, without God worldview, or any other worldview, every worldview has to answer life's big questions, right? Like, who am I? Why am I here? What ought I be doing with my life? And the Christian worldview has a consistent answer to all those questions. Love. Love, love, and love. Who are you? You are a beloved child of God. Why are you here? Because God created you in love for love. What ought you be doing in the meantime? Well, love God, love others. Those are the two commandments that bring the entire law and all the prophets to summation. It's all love for the Christian. But, it's not all love for those who live in a without God worldview. You need to understand how your worldview answers life's big questions. Because it may not be as pleasant as you think. Who am I? Okay, and these are not my words, by the way. These are words of leading scientists who believe in the without God worldview. Who am I? Well, you're not special. You're science. You're a chance collection of molecules that came from an unexplainable explosion and will one day return to dust when the world implodes or explodes. And by the way, no one will ever remember anything anyone ever did. So quit talking about legacy. Quit talking about history. Don't worry about memory because nobody's going to remember. That's who you are. Why am I here? Well, there's no why. You're just decaying matter on decaying matter. Look around. You're here because you evolved to this point accidentally. There's no purpose or meaning. Love is just body chemistry. Hope is just wishful thinking. Creativity is an illusion. Choice is not real. It's all math. It's all math. And what ought I be doing? Well, really probably whatever you want to be doing. Because choice is an illusion anyways, guys. Come on. It's math. Plus, there is no ought. It's a flawed question. There's no ought. There's no good or evil. There's no heroes or villains. There's no right or wrong in a world where there is no absolute standard. Now, everyone likes today to talk about being on the right side of history. But there will be no more history when this all explodes. So just live it up while you can, because someday you're just going to be particles in outer space. That's the logical ends of the without God worldview. Now check this. Here's what I know about you. I don't know what you believe, but I know how you choose to live. And it ain't like that. Man, it's not like that. Because you don't want to be sad all the time. You don't want to be depressed. You don't want to live in that sort of dark and hopeless place. Do you? Like, you believe that human beings are more than just decaying matter on decaying matter. In fact, you believe human beings have real dignity. Why? You believe that human beings have a choice in things, and they're deserving of your love and respect and compassion and care. You believe that purpose and meaning are real. In fact, you've experienced purpose before in raising your kids or caring for a friend or family member. You've tasted meaning when you've used your gifts in the workplace or used your gifts at school and you've accomplished something or moved the ball forward and it was exhilarating, right? You believe in creativity because you've been swept up by human creativity before. There's been a song that's taken your breath, brought you to tears, a piece of art that has allowed you to experience a transcendence beyond yourself. And you believe in right or wrong. You don't think it's all just opinions. Like, you believe there's a standard out there that people could or should comply to. And oh yeah, by the way, you believe in love. In fact, most of us have been in love. Some of you have been in love for 10 years, 20 years, 50 years. And if we were to ask you, you would tell us that the bond you and your partner share, it's more than just body chemistry. In short, I don't know what you believe, but I know how you live. And you do not live as if love, purpose, meaning, morality are all an illusion. No, you live as if they are quite real. But my question is this: do you live that way because your worldview demands it? Or do you live that way even though your worldview points in the exact opposite of it? You see, if you believe in a world without God, then your worldview is the latter, not the former. Which makes many of you in here today a hypocrite. A hypocrite. Your worldview says one thing, but you live in a completely different way. You are what you hate about Christians. With all due respect, you're a hypocrite. And I don't want to live that way, and I know you don't want to live that way. So let me invite you today, just consider this, just chew on this. Let me invite you today to a worldview that actually respects and honors everything science has to offer, but at the same time believes in a loving intelligence behind it all that brings it all together. Let me invite you to a relationship with Jesus. In fact, for some of you today, that's your next step. It's time for you to close the gap. It's time for you to give up the distance between you and God. It's interesting. The Greek word for skeptic actually means to check something out from a distance. Right? And that's smart at first. It's smart to gain evidence to make sure that you're not deceived or fooled. But some of you have been gaining evidence for a long, 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 long time. And there's not a whole lot more evidence to give. You just need to give up the distance if you want to continue to make progress. Especially if the Christian God is in fact a personal God, a relational God. Look, there's no progress in a relationship if you hold it at a distance. You gotta draw near. You have to get close. You have to engage in the conversation and get to know the other person. And that's what I'm challenging you today. Give up the distance between Jesus and you. It's time. Look, investigating something from a distance is a great first step. I'm glad you're listening to this right now. So thankful. But it's the first step, and there is a second one. And that second step is repenting and placing your trust in Jesus. I took that step 24 years ago, and on my journey, I've had some high highs and some low lows. I've had some moments where I've created a lot of distance between me and Jesus. But you know what I found? Every time I turn back and I draw near to him, whether it was the first time or the 100th time, he draws near to me in return. In fact, I stand today on this stage as living proof of the transformative power of Jesus. But my story will not do for you. You got to write your own story. And so I would encourage you, challenge you today to consider giving up the distance between you and Jesus and writing him into your story. And this is the Jesus who you're writing in. Colossians chapter 1, verse 15. Paul writes, we look at this son, Jesus, and we see the God who cannot be seen. We look at this son, and we see God's original purpose in everything created. For everything, absolutely everything, above and below, visible and invisible, rank after rank after rank of angels, everything, y'all, got started in him and finds its purpose in Jesus. He was there before any of it came into existence. And now he holds all of it together right up to this very moment. And when it comes to the church, he organizes and holds it together like a head does a body. He was supreme in the beginning. And leading the resurrection parade, he is supreme in the end. From beginning to end, he's there, towering far above everything, everyone. So spacious is he, so roomy, that everything of God finds its proper place in him without crowding. Not only that, but all the broken and dislocated pieces of the universe, people and things, animals and atoms, get properly fixed and fit together in vibrant harmonies, all because of Jesus' death and his blood poured down from the cross. And you yourselves are a case study of this. So am I. Of what he does. At one time, you all had your backs turned to God, thinking rebellious thoughts of him, giving him trouble every chance you got. But now, by him giving himself completely at the cross, actually dying for you, now Christ has brought you over to God's side and put your lives together, whole and holy in his presence. And you don't walk away from a gift like that. You stay grounded and steady in that bond of trust, constantly tuned into the message, careful not to be distracted or diverted. In fact, there's no other message, just this one. Every creature under heaven gets this same message. And that's my prayer today. God, my prayer is that there may be one, even just one, who would give up their distance today and get this message. The message of Jesus, our crucified, our self-sacrificing, our cross-shaped King. It's in him we're all brought together. Everything is brought together. It's in him that we live our lives. In Jesus' name we pray, amen. I just wanna say thanks for being here. And I want to say to you today that if you feel called to make a decision and give up the distance, right outside those doors right there to the left is our fireside room, and we have pastors in there who want to talk to you about what's next. For the rest of you Northeast people, I love you. Let's go be Jesus to the world. Go love the Ville. Y'all have a great week.